And how beautiful indeed to follow in the steps of the Savior. A joyous thing to follow him, and especially to follow him with other folks who can share that joy with us. And delight to be with you tonight and to have the privilege of worshiping with you and studying with you. You've made already such a pleasant week for me. I don't begin to have the ability to thank you enough for how enjoyable you've made this work. If we can even call it work, it's just so enjoyable. Work doesn't sound like the right word to describe it. But so glad that we can be together tonight, and especially glad for those of you who have driven some distance to be here. So many special people in the audience tonight. I have to resist the temptation just to go around the room and tell you how much I love you. But one very special person I just must mention, and that is Miss Jordan Farquhar. She's here from College Station tonight. I have a lot of young friends, fortunately. And most of the friends I have are younger than I am, I'm noticing, as time goes by. But Jordan is at the platinum elite level in my group of young friends. She's just been a special encourager for several years, and such a great honor to see her face tonight. So thanks to all of you for being here. It is a wonderful thing for us to contemplate the fact that what God has for us in eternity is much better than what we have here tonight. Hard to imagine that, but that's exactly the way it's going to be. And so glad that we can have a few minutes to study together. We're talking, as has been said, about this theme of diligently seeking God. And I know, I feel badly about the fact that so many of you who are visiting tonight have heard these lessons sometimes multiple times. A preacher friend of mine not too long ago said, "Gary, are you still harping on Hebrews 11:6? I said, "Only when asked to. I do not present these lessons except when I'm asked to present them." And so my apologies to those of you who heard these before. But it's an important subject. And we're going to talk tonight about the diligence aspect of seeking God. I think the average American, despite the fact that the poll takers tell us that we're still a religious society in some sense, I think the practical fact of the matter is that the average American hardly ever thinks about God in any practical day-to-day sense. But even if there would be many people who would say they pay some attention to God, maybe even would describe themselves as being religious people, don't think it's certain. It's common for people to seek God with anything that could remotely be described as diligence. Many people, even who would see themselves being very religious people, it's not much more than a matter of convenience in their lives. It's a part of their lifestyle. It fits very nicely in with a lot of other activities in their life, but it's not going to intrude on anything that would be inconvenient. They are not going to passionately seek God with anything that could be called diligence. But that's what we want to talk about tonight. We've been looking at Hebrews 11, verse 6, which in the New King James says, "Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." We talked about whether God can be pleased from this verse. Talks about that question. We answered that in the affirmative, that God can be pleased. We talked about the quality of our faith. We must come to God believing that he is. And we've talked about seeking, what that means, and some of what it doesn't mean. Then last night we talked about the reward, what that is, and why that ought to be so important to us. So let's think for a few minutes tonight about diligence. Why is diligence so important? And if it is important, we may not know why God had that in mind. I suppose God could have done this any way he wanted to. God could have made this something that wouldn't require any effort, that would just be a matter of convenience. But as a matter of fact, diligence is a part of the scheme. But you may be looking at a translation of Hebrews 11, verse 6, and don't see that word. Read it to you from the New King James. God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. But the ESV, which I have in front of me tonight, does not use that term. It just talks about seeking God. God's a rewarder of those who seek him. So people say, what's going on there? Well, what's going on there is that the Greek verb that's translated seek in this verse is a little bit different verb from the usual form of the word seek in Greek. This is the Greek verb seek with the preposition ek on the front of it, which basically means out of or out of. And it's very similar to the distinction in English between saying that you seek something and that you're seeking something out. That's a little bit stronger term, isn't it? It indicates a little bit more diligent search. And so many of the more recent translations will use more than one English word to bring out the strength of that verb, diligently seek or something like that. So the idea is there, and you could see that from the context, even if you didn't know anything about Greek verbs, and I certainly don't know very much about them. But diligently seek is not a bad translation for this verse. Let's contemplate the importance of diligence. I ask you this question: what's the worst insult that it would be possible for somebody to offer to God? What would you say that is? There are a lot of horrible things that you can think of that a person might do that would be terribly offensive to God, but what would be the worst of the worst? Well, if you've read the Bible, I think you probably understand that the sin of indifference comes in for the strongest condemnation of anything else that's condemned in the Scriptures. Strongest language that I know of anywhere in the Old Testament or the New Testament is reserved for those who would say they love God and they're following him, but they're just going through the motions. Those who don't care near as much as they say they do. That is horribly offensive to God. And I'm sure you could think of passages that illustrate that. In Revelation chapter 3, in the letters to the seven churches of Asia, the letter to Laodicea certainly illustrates that, doesn't it? Revelation chapter 3, verse 15, Christ said to the brethren there, I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. Would that you were either cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. For you say, I am rich, I have prospered, I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I may be just cynical, but I think I see a lot of Laodicean churches today. Churches that seem to be made up of people who have prospered materially. They live in nice homes. Their church building is very nice. They wear nice clothes. They drive nice cars. They are enjoyable people to be around. Socially very adept, and they may pride themselves on the fact that we are doing well as a congregation. But from the Lord's perspective, there may not be nearly as much concern for the Lord there as they would like to have you believe. If they would get a letter from the Lord as this church did, the Lord might say, you are totally out of touch with your real condition as I see you, being able to see your heart. You don't care near as much about me as you are pretending that you do when you go through these convenient motions from time to time. And the Lord spared no words, did he, in strong words in describing how offensive that was to him. The King James used the word spew you out of my mouth. The idea really is I will vomit you out of my mouth. That's how detestable it is when somebody's neither hot nor cold, They don't hate the Lord, but they're not deeply in love with him either. It's just a respectable kind of religious routine. All the more common in a society where the society is nominally religious, and you can be that way, and people will think well of you, but it really doesn't cost you anything. Well, that's more offensive to the Lord than if you would just go ahead and declare yourself an outright enemy of God. Just defy him, shake your fist in his face, and say, I will have nothing to do with you. That would be horrible, but that wouldn't be as bad as this sin of being neither hot nor cold. When Jesus, in the 23rd chapter of Matthew, rebuked the Pharisees. And I guess Matthew 23 would be about as strong an example of the Lord's teaching as you could find. What was wrong with the Pharisees? Well, they were church-going people. And they even were proud of themselves because, as they saw it, they cared a lot more about God than anybody else did. But the Lord knew differently. Matthew 23, verse 27. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. That is, you are pretending something. This is not really you. Hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup. I wanted to read in verse 27. You are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others. I'm trying to adjust my microphone here so it doesn't make that sound. You appear outwardly righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. So that's serious, isn't it? When you realize that the worst offense to the Lord, based upon the strong language that we see in the scriptures, is committed by respectable religious people who are outwardly maintaining the form of maybe even correct worship, but in their hearts, it's not anything very, very serious. It doesn't go very deep. Well, how can we avoid that? If you wanted to stay away from that sin of indifference, what would you do? Well, if you're going to seek God, you need to seek Him diligently. This needs to be more than just a casual, convenient pursuit. I said in one of the earlier lessons, if God matters at all, He's all that matters. You know, everything else is peripheral. It doesn't mean that God's the only thing you need to deal with. There are these little daily concerns that we have to take care of. But if there is a God, if we've been made by Him and He holds our eternal destiny in His hands, this is not just one of our concerns. This is the main thing. And we need to seek a right relationship with our Lord with an effort that is rightly described as diligence. If you wanted to make if you wanted to write a recipe for diligence, what ingredients would you put in the mixing bowl? Let's look at some ingredients. First of all, you'd add some sincerity if you wanted to come up with diligence, wouldn't you? A person who seeks God diligently would really and truly care about it. Sincerity means that you feel deeply about something, and it's not pretended. It's true. It's real. And we need to be more sincere, don't we? I sometimes hesitate to make that point. I mean, there are passages in the Bible, where God would seem to say, for example, in Malachi, you just ought to go ahead and shut the doors. If this is the best you're going to do, you're going through, what you're doing is a mockery to me. You'd be better off just to shut the doors. Well, sometimes when I've said that and quoted those passages, I'll have people to say, well, I guess in all honesty, I don't care as much about it as I ought to, so I guess I'll just quit going through the routine. You won't expect to see me back at services. I'm quitting. Well, that's not the right response. Certainly none of us care as deeply as we ought to. We've got room to grow in our sincerity and how strongly we care about these things. And you don't quit until you are as sincere as you ought to be, and then you come back to the Lord. That's not what we're saying. You never do a finer thing than when you go ahead and do what's right, even if your heart is not completely in it right now. You do it because it's right. You do it because this is God, and I'm going to discipline myself to do the best that I can, even if I don't feel it 100% right now. That's not hypocrisy. That's a fine thing. And if you're not able to override your emotions and regularly do things that you don't feel like doing, you're not going to do much of anything worthwhile in this life. That's not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy means deliberately going through the motions to try to convince somebody else that you love God more than you do. That's what the Pharisees were doing. And so if you're not as sincere as you ought to be, I'm not either. But let's don't quit making the effort until we get our sincerity straightened out. Let's grow in our sincerity all the while, doing the best we can to be as pure in our intentions as we ought to. We don't want to play act. We don't want to try to pretend something that we are not. And so if we want to be more diligent, we need to be more sincere. I would add some seriousness to the recipe also. I've sometimes subtitled these lessons, Taking God More Seriously. Well, what do I mean by that? I'm afraid sometimes when I use that word serious, a lot of people think what I mean is, you know, we need to be more serious and frown more often and be more unhappy and never have any lighter moments. No, that's not what I mean. If you know me at all, you know that I enjoy lighter moments. The more of that, the better in life. But if you take something seriously, that doesn't mean you can't laugh at the humorous side of that subject, but it means that that's an important concern rather than just something that's peripheral in your life. My son Grant, for example, is a serious golfer. That doesn't mean he doesn't enjoy a golf joke, that he doesn't see the lighter side of that activity, but he takes it seriously, meaning that he's very diligent in working on his golf game. It's not just a peripheral concern that he doesn't care whether he improves or not. He's a serious golfer. I am not. I'm not a golfer at all anymore, but even when I used to hack around a little bit, I was never anything that anybody could call a serious golfer. I was just a recreational golfer. I didn't really care whether I scored well or not. Just fun to be out there, particularly if you're with somebody you enjoy playing golf with. And because I didn't take it any more seriously than I did, my golf score reflects the fact that it wasn't a serious pursuit with me. So do you see the point? We need to take God more seriously. That doesn't mean we need to frown all the time. It means this needs to be more than just a recreational pursuit. This needs to be the most serious activity of our life. So we could ratchet up the level of our seriousness, couldn't we? We need to be more decisive in seeking God. And Jesus said in Luke chapter 9 and verse 62, that we need to, before we decide to follow the Lord, make up our minds whether we're going to commit ourselves to this. And if we're not committed in it, then don't do it. Luke 9:62, Jesus said, "No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God." That's strong language, isn't it? Hear Jesus say, there's certain people who are not fit to follow me. Who are they? Those who are not commitment keepers, those who don't know anything about following through and doing what they said they would do. I asked many people, "Are you seeking God?" Many would say, "Well, I guess so." I'll share with you a very private moment here. We were talking tonight, I think it was tonight, maybe earlier in the day, about men proposing to the wife to the lady that they hope will say yes and be their wife. And my son Grant is a photographer, and he's embarked on a little sideline business in his photography where he will photograph guys proposing to their girlfriend. He works for the FBI, so he does a lot of clandestine photography anyway. He's got tremendous telephoto lenses, so he can photograph people that don't realize they're being photographed. And so he did his first job last weekend with a young man who's going to propose in Monument Circle there in Indianapolis. So Grant is over in the distance, you know, recording it photographically. And then once she said yes and she was excited, then the guy explained that Grant was in on the deal, and he came in and took some closer pictures. And it was really a neat situation. And I got to thinking about when I proposed to Linda, who used to be my wife. I well remember when I asked her if she'd be my wife, she said, "I guess so." Well, that was humorous for a lot of years, until I found out that there really wasn't any more commitment in it than that. Did you say anything more than that when you said you would follow the Lord? "Well, I guess I will. It's not too hard. It works out okay." One reason many people don't find God in eternity, just because they never really decisively committed themselves to do it and burned their bridges behind them. We live in a society where everybody wants to keep their options open. We don't want to get into anything that we can't get out of if we change our minds. And we apply that to our serving the Lord. It's no wonder that so few people have a close relationship with the Lord, because they've never committed themselves to doing that. It's never been anything more than they said, well, I'll just give it a try. It takes more than that. So to take God, to seek Him more diligently, among other things, would be to be more decisive about it. I would add the word passion. You need to seek God more passionately. And I don't mean by that, of course, sexual passion. That use of the word passion is just a specific use of the word. Passion simply means strong desire, and just so many passages that talk about our needing to love the Lord with a strong desire and to seek Him passionately would not be a bad way to describe it. Romans chapter 12 and verse 11, Paul said, "Do not be slothful in zeal, but be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord." It is an obvious fact, isn't it, that we find a lot of people today who don't think there's anything more than emotion involved in our relationship to the Lord, and there certainly is, but we may go to the opposite extreme of eliminating any emotion whatsoever from the whole operation, and that's just as bad. You know, your emotions should never be in the driver's seat. Your emotions follow from your thinking, and that's what you need to pay primary attention to. If your thinking is correct, then the emotions that flow from that will quite naturally flow from those thoughts. And so you want your thoughts to be truthful and accurate and realistic, so that the emotions that come from that will be what they ought to be. But we need to be passionate about the Lord. We need to feel deeply about this. And I think by the way we've sung together tonight, there is some passion here. And that's exactly as it should be. What a thrill at the emotional level to be seeking the Lord with deeply felt emotion. That's exactly as it should be. And I would add energy. We just seek the Lord energetically. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10, "Whatever you do, do it with all of your might." That's good advice, even in the things of this world, isn't it? Give it all you got. If it's worth doing, do it right, or don't do it at all. It's a saying that you see on the poster some nowadays, "Do it big or stay in bed." Well, that's a pretty good way of saying it. And if that's true in anything, it's true in regard to the Lord. We do not earn our salvation, certainly by our works, but there are works involved that come as a result of our loving the Lord. And what would you work hard at if you didn't work hard at your relationship with the Lord? And who are you fooling to think you're going to make progress in your relationship with the Lord if you're not working on it? It's not a matter of energetically throwing yourself into this enterprise, heart and soul, then why should we be surprised when there's so little results from that? And so persistence would be a part of the recipe also, wouldn't it? 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7, Paul is advising his young brother Timothy. He said, "I have fought the good fight." Paul's speaking here as an older man, getting closer to the goal. He said, "I have fought the fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith." Can you keep going? You seek God sincerely and seriously and decisively and passionately and energetically. Can you keep doing that for a lifetime? You can if you decide to. That's what it comes down to. It's a daily choice. And a daily choice is exactly what it is. Don't think with any of this that I'm suggesting that I can teach you some lesson that will just turn the insights on in your mind and you understand this, and so now I will diligently seek God forever afterwards because I understand how this is supposed to go. No. You will have to make the choice every day, and probably many times every day, to do this and to keep doing it. And I know exactly what you do about this, that it's hard to keep making the choice. There are going to be days when the devil is going to tempt you to believe that the easier and the better thing would be to just to give this up. So you're going to have to keep choosing to keep going, no matter what. And so there's a sense in which maybe with the exception of the final point that we want to make here in just a second, persistence is maybe the next to the most important part of the whole recipe. But the most important part, obviously, would be love, wouldn't it? 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the first couple of verses, Paul makes some pretty amazing statements when he says that if we leave love out of the thing, then nothing else really matters. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. Now look at verse 3. Imagine this. If I give away all I have and if I deliver up my body to be burned but have not love, I gain nothing. If you leave love out of the recipe, none of the rest of it matters. But it is amazing, isn't it, that Paul suggests that it will be possible to do all of these other things and love not be there. I don't know if you've ever looked at the passage in that light, but can you imagine a person who, for some other reason, would go so far as to be a martyr, to give his body to be burned, but he wouldn't do that because of love? Somebody would say, well, that's impossible. Anybody would do that surely has to love the Lord. Well, no. Not necessarily. Anything that might be done for a variety of reasons. Love would only be one of the possible reasons why somebody might do such a drastic thing. But if you did it for some reason other than love, you'd have been wasting your time, wouldn't you? So we did all these other things. We seek God in these ways, but love is not in the mix. Then we've just been spinning our wheels, haven't we? So how do you add love? You decide to add it. Just a tragedy that so many people today define love in purely emotional terms. Well, love is involved, or emotion is involved in it, but biblical love essentially stems from a decision, an act of the will, to act and to do rightly toward God, whether we feel like it at the moment or not. We do that which is right because we love God, and in regard to other people, we'll just do what's right toward them even if they are not lovable and even if they don't deserve it, because that's the way God loves us. It's a choice that we make. Well, I wouldn't suggest you work on all of that at one time. That'd be a little bit much. But if you're like I am, one or two of those might strike your attention. You might say, that's a glaring error, deficiency in my life. Maybe I'm going to start working on that one a little bit. That'd be a step in the right direction. So do you see a little bit of what might be involved in seeking God diligently? I repeat what I said. I know a lot of religious people in the world. As a result of my writing, I'm in communication with a lot of people who come from a lot of different religious backgrounds. And many of them flatter themselves by thinking that they are exceptionally devout. But you look under the hood in their life, you won't see much of any of this. You'll see it just kind of being a convenient part of their respectable American lifestyle. Judgment Day is going to hold some surprises, is it not? When we find out who really has diligently sought the Lord and who's just been going through the motions. I expect all of us will be surprised that some of those that we thought were the most faithful brethren we knew weren't doing anything more than just outwardly going through the motions, and they fooled us into thinking that they were diligently seeking the Lord when they weren't. And there may be some other members of the congregation that you weren't sure about them spiritually, but turns out that inwardly, the Lord, as he saw their hearts, saw a lot more diligence there than you ever knew about. What's in your heart? And what's in mine? I would say, if I wanted to describe it differently, I would say that there are two components to diligence. You seek God as we ought to, you would seek him both fervently and faithfully. I think you have to have both of those. And it's hard to keep those in balance, as I said in an earlier lesson. Fervently means the passion, the fervor, the desire, the love, and all of that. Faithfulness then indicates that we seek God within the boundaries of his will. He has the right to stipulate how we will approach him. He's the king. He gets to dictate how this will go. It is the height of nothing more than the height of arrogance for us to say, here's how I will seek God. Here's what I think God ought to be, and here's how I will seek him. What arrogance. To seek God, we must, yes, be passionate about it. But God will get to dictate how he may be approached. You think of many Bible stories, can't you, when people flippantly thought that they could do anything they wanted to, and some of them died in the process of finding that God gets to set the rules of how this is going to go. You cannot serve God fervently and not serve him faithfully and get the desired result. Neither can you serve God or seek him faithfully, pay attention to obedience and his sovereignty and all of that, leave out the fervency, you won't get the right result either. Both of them have to be there. We see that in the marriage relationship, don't we? How should you love your spouse? Both fervently and faithfully. You said, honey, I love you with all of my heart. I'm passionately in love with you. You are my soulmate. But let's don't be hung up on all of these rules about this relationship. I'll do what I want to, and you surely won't mind if I have some other lovers, will you? Let's don't get hung up on rules. Your soulmate would remind you that fervency in the love relationship requires staying inside the boundaries, or you destroy the relationship. That was the essential lie of the devil in the Garden of Eden that got the whole ugly process of sin started in this world. Is exactly what he suggested to Eve when he said, you don't need to pay too much attention to these rules that God has put down for you. Love God and do what you want to. And since then, people have been deluded into thinking that it can be just about love and I don't have to pay attention to the faithfulness. The other problem, of course, is that we become so obsessed with the rules that we think, that's all there is. We forget the person who's waiting to have a relationship with us inside those rules. But in marriage and in our love affair with the Lord, both have to be there. And I think if you can hang on to both of those and you see yourself getting imbalanced in one way or the other, make the necessary adjustments so that you keep both of those in view. To the extent we can seek God both fervently and faithfully, I believe that'd be another way of saying that we're seeking him diligently. You'll spend the rest of your lifetime finding out what's involved in both of those. What would it mean to seek God fervently? And what would it mean to seek him faithfully at the same time? I believe that's one way of saying what diligently seeking God would be. If you'll seek God diligently, I want to tell you, it'll make a great difference in your life. You'll find your life being transformed, sometimes in surprising ways, if you will commit yourself to seeking God diligently. For one thing, you'll find yourself having greater impact on other people than you ever did before. You want to have some impact on some people? We all do, don't we? Aren't there some people that you would dearly love to influence in God's direction? And we sometimes pull out what hair we have left in agony over, how can I influence them? Why is it that everything I try to do, they just not don't seem to be interested in that? Well, nothing any of us can do is going to influence everybody. The Lord himself was not capable of doing that. If you taught the Lord perfectly truly and with perfect good judgment, some people would still say no. But I verily believe that many of us don't have any more impact than we do because we don't care nearly as much about God as we pretend that we do. And people can tell that. You want to have greater impact? Seek God diligently. And it'll rub off on some other folks. They'll sense that that's genuine, that's true, that's real. And some of them will ask some questions about that. It'll give you some teaching opportunities. I told those of you here Sunday about this homeless gal back in Nashville that I've been trying to help for the last several months. Her name is Stephanie, and she really is a neat person in a lot of ways. She just is falling through the cracks in life, finds herself in a very difficult situation. She's got two children, they live on the street. She's able to make enough money. in a day to run a cheap hotel room. They stay in a cheap hotel room at night, and if not, they stay in a homeless mission in downtown Nashville. I've been trying to help her. It's hard sometimes to know how to help, even when you want to help. Sometimes it's hard to have the wisdom to know how to help people, but I've been trying now for several months, and I think I have been of some help to her. You know, we're wrestling with how to help her spiritually. That's the best kind of help, the most kind of help that I want to eventually be able to give to her. As I was agonizing about that, I've hired her to do some housework for me. First time she ever came to my house, she looked at my place, and it was way overdue for a cleaning. And she looked at it and said, "Oh my." I said, "That's bad when a homeless person who didn't even have a home thinks yours is a mess, you know?" But she's a hard worker, and she's helped clean it up, and she's done some good work for me. I hadn't said anything about the Lord to her for quite a while. But not too long ago, she said, "Gary," she said, "you go to church anywhere? There's something different about you." The door's wide open. She'll listen, I think. Whether I'll ever be able to lead her to the Lord, I don't know. I would hope so. But impact comes from loving the Lord truly, doing more than just going to church services and being a member of a sound congregation. We wonder why our friends and neighbors won't read the tracts that we give them and those kinds of things. Maybe they sense that despite the fact that we say this is the most important thing in our life, they may be able to pick up on the fact that really and truly, this is not much more than a routine with us. And if it's not anything more than that to us, why should it be anything more than that to them? And I'll tell you, is there anybody else who knows whether you're just going through the motions or not? Your kids know. You want to have any impact on your kids, this had better be real with you. Because they can tell if it's not. They see you 24/7. You know, I live in Nashville, the buckle of the Bible Belt. They've lived in that environment, grown up in that environment. You know, their families have been religious families for generations. And what we see so often in Nashville now is parents whose kids, the minute they get their independence, leave any semblance of religion in their life and never turn back. The minute they're free, they're done with all this religious stuff that their parents tried to teach them. And many of these are parents who are members of the Lord's church. And they don't understand. Many of them will come to me and say, "Gary, why did they leave? We took them to church the whole time they were growing up." Well, I'm glad that they did. That's a step in the right direction. But if that's all it was, if your kids who knew you 24/7 could see that this church going was just a routine part of your life and that it really had no impact on the person that you were any other time, why should they want to have anything to do with that? They can have exactly the same middle-class American lifestyle that you have without this religion business. Many of them don't want to hear that. And their response will be, "What do you mean? I go to church. I go to a sound church. How could there be anything more than that?" Well, there's a lot more than that. There's diligently seeking God. And we want to have impact. We need to get into this heart and soul. One of the most sobering passages in the Bible is in Ezekiel chapter 36 and verse 23, when the Lord rebuked the people of Israel, who would have wrung their hands in worry, "Why don't the Gentiles love God like we do? Why don't they worship the true God like we do?" And God said to them, "The nations will hallow me in their hearts when they see me hallowed in your lives. You start taking me seriously, then others may be expected to follow that example." But Israel was a horrible example. Truth was, they didn't love God as much as some of their pagan neighbors did. They were in worse shape than their heathen neighbors were. So impact comes from diligently seeking God. Deeper peace comes from seriously regarding the Lord. Everybody wants peace, don't they? We want to be able to go to bed at night and drift off to sleep without lying awake all night, worrying and agonizing. Where does peace come from? I'll tell you, people seek it in a lot of different places, don't they? Some seek it with drugs and psychology and religion and a lot of other things. Well, I'll tell you where peace comes from. It comes from doing what's right toward God. You go to bed tonight, and despite your mistakes, you can be able to honestly say, I did what was right. I made the tough choices. Maybe it required sacrifice, but I can go to sleep at night knowing that I did what was right. That's where peace comes from. And to do what's right toward God involves dealing with Him on a serious level, seeking Him diligently. One reason many of us don't have any more peace than we do is because we're just going to church. We're just going through the routine. And then we wonder why we don't have any more peace than we do. And finally, deeper joy. We all want that too, don't we? But it comes, strangely enough, from embarking on the seemingly dangerous life of faith. It's interesting to me that a lot of people think they want a life full of joy, this deep, tingling joy, but they want to get that sitting in a recliner thinking about it. Well, it doesn't come from that source. It is interesting, isn't it, that the people in the entertainment business that build theme parks entertain people by putting them on rides that scare the living daylights out of them. I'll tell you something about how we are made. Deep joy comes from adventure, from accepting risk, from doing dangerous things. People trivialize that by being thrill seekers in an earthly kind of sense. But spiritually speaking, joy comes from a life of faith, and a life of faith is a life where you don't know what's going to happen next. You've embarked on following the Lord, and you don't know where that's going to lead, but you will go wherever it is, at whatever risk, even if it terrifies you. You wonder why you don't have any more joy in your life. It may be because there's no more faith, no more risk-taking than that. You're playing it safe and wondering why this is not any better experience than it is. It doesn't come from playing it safe. You study anybody that you want to in the Bible who walked by faith, opened themselves up to serious difficulty and danger and risk, willing to do things at God's bidding that seemed like disaster, that they would do it because this is God's will, despite the difficulty, and sometimes despite the fact that people put them to death for doing that, they had deep joy. That's where joy comes from. Not from the conventional, respectable, play-it-safe lifestyle. So get out on the end of the limb. Trust the Lord. Do things that your friends are going to scratch their heads and say, that's crazy. That's going to work out badly. And put it in the Lord's hands. I live a different kind of life than even a lot of preachers do. I do not receive full support from any one congregation. I'm a member of the Woodland Hills congregation in Nashville, Tennessee, and that's where I worship on the rare occasion when I'm home. But I receive my support from some congregations, Twin City Congregation in College Station, Texas, on that list, I'm thankful to say, but from a lot of individuals who help just because they want to be a part of this work, and some of them sacrificially will say, Gary, I want to help you, and I don't know if I can do this long term, but I'm going to send you something this month, and if I can next month, I'll send you something. And there's one widow lady that sends me $25 a month out of her Social Security check. She can't afford to do that. And I don't know how long she'll be able to continue to do that. I don't know how long any of these people will continue to support me. I go month to month. It's a much more adventuresome lifestyle than I remember having when I got a check from a congregation and it was stable, and at least for a while, and everything looked pretty safe. But I'll tell you, I live a life of joy now that I never knew about before, because I believe there's more faith involved in it. There's more risk. There's more adventure in committing yourself unreservedly to doing what is right, to doing what you can do in the Lord's work, taking some risks, doing some unconventional things, always within the Lord's will, but things that you're not sure how those are going to work out if the Lord doesn't keep the safety net under you, and you just have to trust that He will do that. That's where joy comes from. And that's diligence. That's taking God seriously. I recommend to you to try a little bit of that. See if it's not better. So, progress, and we want to make progress, don't we, in our spiritual lives, it comes from discipline. Nobody ever made any significant progress in anything without disciplining themselves to focus on that and lay aside other concerns that would interfere with it. We certainly see that in the life of athletes, don't we? Whoever became a world-class athlete by just sitting around thinking how nice that would be, I'll drink all the Cokes that I want to and eat all the Krispy Kreme donuts that I want to, but I'm going to be a world-class athlete. Now, they don't make much progress, do they? It comes from discipline, and the Bible unhesitatingly uses that concept of discipline to describe how we make progress spiritually. 1 Timothy 4, verse 15, I've read this passage several times already. Practice these things, Paul said. Immerse yourself in them so that all may see your progress. Those who know you well see you making progress? I hope they do. If it's been a long time since anybody said, I can see that you're growing spiritually. You're in a different place than where you were a year ago. And you need to be worried because you might not be making any progress. And it might be because you're not applying any discipline to the situation. Practice these things. Is it the New King James that says, give yourself entirely to these things? Immerse yourself in them so that your progress, others may see your progress. But not only discipline, if we're going to be good stewards of these resources that the Lord has entrusted to us, it's going to take diligence. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15, a passage that many of us memorized as children, I'm persuaded. The ESV says, do your best to present yourself to God as one approved, a worker who has no need to be ashamed, rightly handling the word of truth. A wonderful verse, isn't it? What's the point? He talks about us being workers. I don't know if you've ever worked in a factory on an assembly line where you do something and then at the end of the line an inspector has to inspect the workmanship. The idea here is that we are workers in the Lord and ultimately our workmanship is going to be inspected. So do your work. Give diligence. Work hard at what you do so that when the Lord inspects your work, you won't have to hang your head in embarrassment and say, well, I should have done better than that. And I knew I should. I just was slacking on. You won't ever be able to offer the Lord a perfectly crafted life. But Paul says, let's give some diligence in our stewardship and this workmanship that we're privileged to be a part of, so that we can say, I'm giving this all I've got. I'm doing the best I can. And the Lord will accept that. And forgive you of the flaws in that workmanship by His grace. But you want to be able at the end of your life to offer to the Lord something that you're not embarrassed to give to Him. You want to say, Lord, I'm pleased to be able to give you the best that I can do. Some are not going to be able to do that. Some will be embarrassed when that inspection time comes. So Paul says, give diligence, the older version said. Or study, that which means to make a studied effort to this relationship with the Lord so that we won't have to be ashamed of our workmanship. Certainly, God deserves nothing less. We dishonor God if we approach Him with anything less than diligence. He's the number one question in life. He's the number one issue that needs to be dealt with. And that's true even if you're not a Christian. If you've given thought to whether you need to become a Christian or not, tell you, there's not any question you need to be dealing with any more than that. Again, the worst insult you could offer to God is not to say, I reject you, I've thought about this, I want no part of this plan of salvation that you've got, I want nothing to do with your son, Jesus Christ. That would not be nearly as offensive as if you said, well, this might be important, but I've really got other things to think about today. How offensive to the Lord to say, in effect, you're not even important enough for me to make a decision about it right now. I've got more important things to do. You couldn't be more offensive than that. God deserves anything. He deserves careful, concentrated approach to this whole question of even whether he exists or not. And if he does, what is his will? How is it possible for us to have a right relationship with him? You will honor God by taking this very seriously. So, either we give God all we've got, or he will accept nothing at all. Jesus made it just that clear, didn't he? Matthew 12, verse 30, he who is not with me is against me. And there will be no middle category in eternity of people who were neither cold nor hot, they were just kind of lukewarm, and so the Lord assigned them to just kind of a mediocre place in eternity. Be either for me or against me. And we are making our decision every day with every act in which we engage. None of us is standing still. You're not moving toward God with greater diligence and with greater discipline and greater gratitude and reverence and faithfulness and fervency and all those things. Then you're going the other way. As I said to those who were here this morning, I constantly hear people excuse their lackadaisical approach to God, constantly excuse themselves for doing things that they know they ought not to be doing, and you ask them about it, and they say, well, Gary, we are all works in progress. So get off my case. Well, we all are works in progress. In a certain extent, as I said this morning, you're not a work in progress unless you're making progress. If you're not making progress, you're a work in regress. You're going the other way. Which is it? Choice has to be made, and eternity will simply be the ratification of whichever decision we make about it. We either grow toward God or we grow toward the devil. And then in, C.S. Lewis was exactly right when he said there'd only be two classes of people. Those who have said to God, your will be done. And those to whom God will have to say, okay, your will be done. I'll never bother you again. Which is serious business. We're going to seek God. Let's seek him diligently or not at all. Where are you tonight in regard to God? I hope that you're walking faithfully with him. I know that some of you are. You help me in my walk. I wish that some of you could know how much you help me. I sit here looking at old Sherry Mock tonight. Good grief, how she has encouraged me. If Tony ever kicks over, I'm going to have to reconsider my vow not to remarry. I'm going to be after Sherry. But unfortunately, I've made that vow, and that won't be a possibility. But she has encouraged me to keep going. And old Chuck Durham back there, bless his frustrating heart sometimes to me. Chuck's a unique case. But how encouraging he's been to me. And many of you have been encouraging. I thank you for that. But is there some step you need to take that we could help you with to be one step closer to God than you were before you got here? If that's something we can help you with, and the reason we sing this invitation song is to give you an opportunity to let us know how we can help you. Don't be embarrassed about it. If you think you won't do what's right in this assembly, you'll wait till it's not quite so public and not so embarrassing. Let me tell you, if you won't risk a little embarrassment to do what's right, don't fool yourself into thinking that you would make any significant sacrifice. You start out following the Lord by trying to find the most convenient and least embarrassing time to do that. That's not a good way to start. The Lord said, pick up your cross and follow me. So whatever it takes, if we can help you, don't let this moment slip you by. How can we help you? You let us know right now while we stand and sing the invitation song.